Well, thank you very much, Alan. I like to say that in this public health game that I've been playing for more years than I like to remember, it gives you the opportunity of being fired from some of the best jobs in the country. And I frankly have to admit that that has been true in my career. We're going to talk a little bit today about the recent development in health reform, which we all know to be the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which President Obama, of course, signed in 2010 after a year and a half of really acrimonious debate in the Congress, as we all remember. But the fact is the law was signed. It became a piece of legislation that was on and is ongoing today. We are going to talk a little bit about the Supreme Court program. Before going forward, let me just make the point. For those of you who want more information on the Affordable Care Act, I would strongly recommend www.healthcare.gov. You can get almost all the answers you need from that particular governmental website, or you can go to the Kaiser Family Foundation, health.org, KFF.org, and then there's the AARP, www.aarp/getthefacts. The APHA has a very good website as well, and the media relations at APHA. So these are places to get more information than you'll learn here today, and they will be helpful to you as public health physicians as we move forward. I want to talk a little bit about the Affordable Care Act in terms of the history of health reform in this country. It goes back a long way, and my view has always been that if you understand a little bit about how you got someplace, you can figure out how to get from that place to someplace else. If you know your history, you don't have to repeat the mistakes. You can move forward. So we'll talk a little bit about the history. We'll talk a little bit about the problems that exist in the public health system, the benefits to public health from the PPACA. And I will talk a little bit about the future, which is almost upon us. And that I think, may be the most important aspect of this discussion, because so much is dependent on whom we elect in this next election a week and a half from now. So the history is very simple. Healthcare was something that the ancient Egyptians and the ancient Chinese were supportive of. Egyptians, actually, you know, most people don't know this, but there was a universal coverage system in Egypt 5,000 years ago. It was free. And the way it worked was this. If you were sick, you could go to the temple in Thebes, and the priests would provide their ministrations to you. And this was free. You could get it once a year. So universal health care was a once-a-year process. There may be some in this country who would like to see it that way, but that's not my view. But the Chinese even had a more interesting approach. And most of you know about the Chinese medicine, where you paid your doctor in advance to keep you healthy, but when you got sick, then it was his turn and he had to pay you. That's basically an HMO. So if you don't like HMOs, blame the Chinese. Now, we do go, and I have a nice picture in another section, but I don't have it here. Really, health reform in this country, in the United States, goes back to our very beginning. John Adams signed the Merchant Seamen's Act in 1798, which created not only the parent of the future of the public health system as we know it today, but it created a governmentally run medical system that was paid for by an insurance plan that was mandated by all, for those who were merchant seamen. They had to pay 25 cents or something like that from their salary every month into the federal budget, so that the federal government could build hospitals, provide doctors and nurses for merchant seamen who, when they got sick in New Orleans, say, couldn't go back to their doctor in Boston. So it was a way of protecting the economy of the United States by protecting those who were central to the economic process that was going on. That was the shipping of goods and services around the country. The Merchant Seamen's Act, as you know, was vetoed out or was removed as part of our system in 19, 82 by President Reagan as a budget-saving device, but its history is rich, both in terms of providing hospitals for care of people who were associated with Merchant Marine, also with people who were members of the federal establishment, whether military or diplomatic, and the public health hospitals that existed up to that time. There were 29 of them, I think, by the time it was canceled out. They were all over the country, and many of us probably served and trained in those hospitals as well. It is, however, the parent of the public health service, and it was the public health service that grew out of the Merchant Seaman program, and which today, of course, is the parent of CDC and all of the other good things that have happened in preventive medicine. So the But Zori doesn't stop there. The concern for health in this country has been continuing. Dorothea Dix, in the middle part of the 19th century, encouraged Congress to pass a piece of legislation to provide in the District of Columbia a hospital for what they called in those days the indigent insane. We have that hospital today. It's the St. Elizabeth's Hospital. A year later, and that was signed by President Fillmore. A year later, with a new president, President Franklin Pierce, the same legislation was passed by the Congress to encourage the Congress to provide resources to every state to build mental health hospitals and serve the needs of the indigent insane in those hospitals, with the conception being, and again, it's an economic conception, that by curing, quote unquote, by curing those who were mentally deranged, making them productive members of society again, the Congress would be serving the economic needs of this country by putting people to work. Unfortunately, Franklin Pierce had a slightly different view toward this group of people than his predecessor. And in his veto message, which I urge you to read, you can get it off the internet, the veto message of this proposition, he stipulated that while this is a good idea and an excellent program, it is something that we should not do because it is not the responsibility of Congress to serve the needs of this population, because even though this population of insane people might be worth doing, we do not want to get into the role of Congress putting money out to cover the problems of the poor. So you have this dichotomy stipulated in a veto message between the concept of the welfare state that was approved by Congress and the concept of not supporting a welfare state, which Franklin Pierce stipulated in his veto message. And it's interesting, in the history of this country, the same dialogue goes on in 1912, we'll talk about Teddy Roosevelt. In 1937, we'll talk about FDR. In 1948, 1865, and again in 94, and again today. So that there is this ongoing process of tension between that which we do for others is good for the society, the concept of we are our brother's keeper, the concept that which you do for the least of us, you do for us. Those concepts, which are very American in tradition and very Judeo-Christian in tradition, are in conflict with the notion of individual rights, states' rights, the idea that if you can't cut it yourself, Jack, it's your problem. The notion of the individual who goes to the West and cuts himself his own land and lives off the ground and does his own thing and is independent of the federal government. And that concept goes back right to our founding fathers, this notion of doing for yourself and not asking the big government to do it. And we see that, of course, today. And I think it's important to be aware of those first three items. The item with regard to Teddy Roosevelt is interesting because we all know that when he ran in 1912 on the Bull Moose Party, one of the planks was universal health coverage. not a long plank. It just says if I'm elected, or if a full moose party is elected, we will support a universal coverage system. At that time, Teddy Roosevelt's physician, who happened to have been a member, who had happened to have been the president of the American Medical Association 2 years earlier, and his name eludes me at the present time, but it's in the record, was in fact a strong supporter of Teddy Roosevelt's view with regard to universal coverage, and a resolution had been passed by the American Medical Association in that period of time in support of that notion. So that in 1912, the American Medical Association in fact supported what we all have come to believe as a universal health system. Ironically, at that time, those who were fighting against that concept were those who helped to elect Woodrow Wilson, the labor unions of this country. And the labor unions of this country fought it not because they were against health care for labor, laborers or employees, but because it was one of the most important elements in their efforts in fighting business. In other words, if you lost the element of being able to argue for better health care or support of health services, you would lose one of the major pieces of leverage that unions had to attract people into the union. So this, and you see this again and again, the unions in the 40s worked for health care. The unions in the 50s began to work for health care, and then, of course, they began to support universal coverage. I won't talk about I won't talk about Harry Truman's misstep in 1948. We can get to that in the questions if necessary. But Lyndon Johnson, of course, passed the Medicare and Medicaid, and then, of course, we saw the failure of the Clinton program in the 90s and the great success in 2010 of the Barack Obama program for the Affordable Care Act. Now, I'll go through these problems very quickly. You know the problem of 2.6 million, the access to 50 million people without insurance, quality, we're number 37, at least bad in terms of infant mortality and all those things. We all know these issues. The market, let the market decide, no socialized medicine, repeal Obamacare. We all know that. There are also several problems in the public health field, which I think it's important for us to consider as we think about the Affordable Care Act, because so many of those problems relate to the government structure in which we live. The fact that we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and more governmental agencies all involved in providing health on different sides is a major problem that needs somehow to be resolved. We need to have coherency and structure in our government. As a matter of fact, just this morning we were talking that the personnel department of the United States government, the agency that runs the governmental health plan for congressmen and for all government employees, is considering placing a public option on the exchanges, which we fought so hard to get into the law and which we don't have in the law, but now they're talking about putting it in so that the exchanges in every state in the union, when they get created a year from now, will in fact have an option run by at least one nonprofit organization that will provide the same structure of insurance that congressmen have, that federal employees have, judges have, and so on. In other words, a federalized program for options, for a public option that people will be able to choose under the rubric of the Affordable Care Act. Now, this could lead to even further chaos than may exist in this thing. We have DHS, of course, with all of the programs in DHS, with CDC, Prison Health, and NIOSH, and so on and so forth. And sometimes you have to ask the question, does Congress have an understanding of what it is that really is meaningful with regard to universal health care or the provision of services for everyone? Sometimes when you look at the way in which Congress acts, they put politics above people. They put personal gain above situation. And I'm not even going to begin to talk about Congress, but sometimes you have to ask the question, do they have a clue? And then we have the 55 states. If every state organizes a set of exchanges, are we going to get into the same kind of chaos that we have today with 55 distinctly different Medicaid programs, all of which under the federal Medicaid law were supposed to provide medical care to the indigent, to the medically indigent, under a joint relationship with the feds and the states. And yet you can't go from Arizona to California and transfer your Medicaid program to California, and you certainly can't go from Massachusetts to New York and do it. Once, when you move between states, if you take a different job, if you happen to get a job, you start all over again. There's no, you can't get your records. It's chaos. So one has to ask the question, are the states part of the problem? Are the Medicaid programs part of the problem? Will the Affordable Care Act solve any of those problems, or will it just make the problems worse? We heard a discussion yesterday about the problems that exist in Switzerland with regard to a universal coverage system, but they have multiple insurance programs that can buy your insurance from. And the guy who was speaking to us was one of the chief deputies in the Swiss government. He described the program as somewhere between heaven and hell, and that it was the hell part that really made it difficult, because these different agencies, these different insurance plans, private insurance coverage plans, were causing so much problem. Now, and then, of course, we have all the associations with regard to ASTO, NATO, and so on. And the real question, where is the leadership? Where is the leadership in this program? And I think that's something that we need to think about. But let's first talk about what it is the Affordable Care Act and the public health system in large, in general, really is trying to achieve. Now, we know that many of the problems in public health begin with the physical system. You don't have to live in Phoenix very long to know that the problems of heat and dryness and so on are a result of the physical and the meteorological environment, and have very little to do with the sociocultural environment. But the sociocultural environment has an impact as well, as does the biological environment. And I like to think in terms of if we as public health physicians are going to be working with the Affordable Care Act and asking the Affordable Care Act to help us, we'd better darn well not lose sight of the fact that where we live, who we are, and the culture out of which we come defines the health services that we are willing and able to achieve. And, of course, sitting right on top of that is kind of a Band-Aid over this thing, is the health system. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the health system. But you have all these other occupational health, air pollution problems, drinking water, food and safety. In public health, we deal with this all the time, every single day. But what we don't deal with, and which we should be dealing with more frequently, is the health system, because it is these problems that generate the problems that our clinical colleagues see and then report to us in disease reports or whatever that we have to go out and deal with. Now, let's ask ourselves, if we're going to deal with the public, with the health system at large, where does public health, the program that we're involved in, where does public health fit into this, what I like to call the railroad model? Over there, basically the public health system is the first railroad car from the community. And frankly, let's put up these numbers. Frankly, 312 million people are engaged at some time or another in the public health system. Well, they go to a public drinking fountain and drink water. That's public health. They go to a restaurant and they don't come down with diarrhea disease. That's public health. The fact that there's laws that says your kids have to be immunized, that's public health. So everybody in this country is dealing with the public health system. Pre-hospital, I put that in as the ambulance services, because many of us in public health deal with the ambulance system. I know in Los Angeles we did, certainly. The biggest part of the system, of course, is both the ambulatory care and the hospital side. And on the ambulatory side, we get over a billion visits a year. Those numbers up there are visits to the clinical side. And of course, on the hospital side, we have 35 million administrative admissions to hospitals, 35 admissions to hospitals in a population of 310 million people. You know, that's like, that's like 110 admissions per 1,000 population. Not a trivial number, much higher than in other countries around the countryside. And also, those admissions generate 166 million bed days, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. 6 million people in long-term care facilities, 3 million people in home care. Maybe those will change. Now, bills of the costs, you're all familiar with that, $2.6 trillion. We don't have to go through it, but you can see we are down at the bottom of the game. We are less than 3% or less than 2%. Giorgio, good grief, how are you, man? I get all my friends who are coming in here. Good grief. Great to see you, pal.
At least we weren't talking about the health system problems.
Right. One of the solvers of these problems. For those who don't know, Giorgio Pacai, one of the great solvers in the Health Planning Act, let me tell you. But anyway, be that as it may, these are the numbers, or at least proximate numbers of the costs, and they're incredibly high. But we must remember that the Affordable Care Act has assigned a small amount of money, but not a trivial amount of money. $650 million for public health and expansion of preventive services. Now, let's see what that really means. What do we got here? Let's go back one. This circle that I put up on the board really is where that $650 million will be spent across the board. And we're going to talk a little bit more in a moment as to where you can separate this out, because if you look at the Act, there's community prevention, almost $300 million in state and local support services. Tobacco prevention, that could be used in every public health department around this country. Obesity and fitness, $16 million. We can't be very fat if they're only putting in $16 million. But hopefully we can expand that. And we'll talk a little bit about later as to what we have to do as public health professionals engaged in the public service can do to serve this problem. Clinical prevention, mostly wellness and fitness programs, certainly amount of vaccination is in there. Behavioral health and primary care, a big area that we may not get into discuss, but it's an important area. The third area is infrastructure and training. I'm not sure exactly I know what infrastructure means. It's defined in the package. Maybe we can just talk about that under the questions. The expanding the workforce. We have friends today who are engaged in programs training them in primary services who are being covered by the money that's here in this program, so that the primary care service delivery system, which is going to be impacted when you put 40 more million or 30 more million people into the system, the primary care system is being expanded today through these $45 million dollars in the workforce, expanding the workforce. Public health capacity, that should have an impact on every public health department in the country. More epidemiologists, more disease investigators, more preventive medicine people, and so on. How that will work out, I think we'll have to watch it through time. And there's research, there's healthcare surveillance, again, a public health, very important public health area, and preventive research under the United States Task Force for Preventive Services, which we have an expert in the room who can talk about that, right, Robert? And how the task force is one of our friends. A good one. Okay, so the $650 million. Now, where will that go on this system? As I read the Act, it looks like Part A will cover the whole ballgame. There'll be tobacco and obesity fitness training, which we can spread both from the public health sector all the way through the clinical sector and even into the long-term care and home care. I think one of the roles that public health is going to have to consider is how we go about working with long-term care and home care and the nursing programs in the outreach nursing programs to make sure that things like tobacco control and things like prevention or cessation and things like obesity management can be carried out across that spectrum, because It doesn't matter where you are. If you're smoking and fat, you're going to have more disease than the skinny non-smokers, and we all know that. Now, what about Part B, the wellness and behavioral stuff, the mental health issues? Clearly, we won't have as much role to play in that as will our clinical colleagues in primary care specifically. One of the things I see as a great advantage of the sections of the Affordable Care Act, which talk about providing under the insurance plans that will be sold to everyone, comprehensive mental health services, early diagnostic services, services for the drugs that are needed. We don't have to wait for people to be so sick that they either shoot up their family or shoot up a restaurant or a theater, but that we can contact them early and give them the kind of primary preventive mental health services that hopefully will reduce some of the egregious events that we've read about just recently. But those monies will not be coming to public health. Hopefully they will be coming and being used appropriately in the clinical side. This is what I think is a big aspect of the public health side. We should be asking ourselves, working with our colleagues in the academic realm, working with our colleagues in the medical schools and in the nursing programs, how can we increase public health training using these resources, $137 million this year and hopefully more in the future, to build our primary services, to build primary care providers, to enhance the public health infrastructure in ways that are consistent with the project. And, of course, Part D, health surveillance, again, that's across the entire board. Is this enough? No, it is not enough. But it is a start, and it is probably the first time in a universal context the needs of prevention and public health are addressed, articulated in a piece of legislation. If you look at prior, there's all kinds of legislation, the Ryan White Act, Title 10, and so on. There's hundreds of pieces of legislation, and they focus on this problem or that problem or this problem. I see this Affordable Care Act, the prevention aspects of it, as dealing with the whole enchilada and asking us in public health and in clinical medicine to deal with the concept of lowering the incidence of disease before it becomes manifest. That has not been done either under Medicare in the past. And it was done under Medicaid, and I think Medicaid, with the early interventions and so on, a success in that regard to some degree. Now, let me ask another question. What I want to show here are two things that relate to prevention. In the first box, what we're talking about is the population distribution of those who are healthy and insured, those who are unhealthy and insured, and those who are on Medicare, SSI, that's that little red slot, and who are the Medicare population who are elderly. I don't know if you can distinguish the colors, but the insured population who are healthy is a big blue section. Over half the people in this country are reasonably healthy, and they're insured, and they don't use much in the way of health care. We're going to talk about that in a minute. The 14% who are the elderly, we know they have Medicare, but they're, like me, they're a little bit sicker than they were 10, 20, 30 years ago. But if we have good primary, secondary, tertiary coverage, our costs are going to be less, as we have known. And if we now add to that the preventive services that have been introduced into the Medicare program by the Affordable Care Act, those of us who used to hold off and say, I don't need the vaccines, it's going to cost me $10. I don't need to get an annual physical because it's going to be $100. So I'll forget it and I'll just see my doctor when I... Today, the Affordable Care Act covers all the preventive stuff. So I can get my flu shot and I can get my pneumonia shot and I can get what's the other one I need to get? The zoster shot. What the hell is that one? Shingle shot. I haven't done any of them, but I can get them for free for crying out loud. I'm afraid of news. But let's look at this one. This is really the chart that costs us money, because what you're dealing with what you're dealing with here is over half of the money that's being spent in the healthcare system, over $1 trillion, is being spent on this group of people who are insured but who are sick. Now, don't you think if we had done something 10 years ago, or maybe 15, or maybe 30, with those people in terms of getting them to stop smoking, maybe encourage them not to drink so much, maybe to encourage them to lose a little weight so that their 300 pounds could be donated to something else. If we had done that, I mean, I don't know. I don't have a good profile on who that 14% is, but I do know they eat a lot of money. Come on in. They eat up a lot of money, and they eat up money because their care was spotty and in short supply early, and I mean not early enough to prevent their disease. If you look at the blue chart, the healthy folks, it's collapsed down to 15%. We don't spend any of that money at all, less than 15% of the total. The interesting thing is, if you look at the 14% of our population who are not insured at the present time, who will be insured at least to a fairly large extent under the Affordable Care Act, today they're only consuming 4% of the money that's spent in health care. How is that possible? That's right. They don't go to the doctor. Oh, they end up in the emergency room when they're really sick. But most of the time, these uninsured people are reasonably young, reasonably healthy. They sort of sit on their diseases. They allow their back pain to be back pain. They don't go to the doctor when they have bad headaches and so on and so forth. And maybe most of the time it gets better. They consume a hell of a lot less than they probably should. That's going to change. That's going to change. Because when we provide everybody with insurance, those guys are going to come marching into their primary care docs. We better have primary care docs. We better be working to expand the primary care system. And we better have a way of managing their early diagnostic problems, their early problems, so that they don't become like the one point, like the greens here on this chart. That is going to be the goal of preventive medicine and public health, because some of this, and God, I don't know how much of it, certainly going back to the three circles a few minutes ago, some of this is environmental, some of this is biological, some of this is cultural, which we in public health have a degree of a handle on. All you have to talk about, and I look at my wife, who was the school health director in D.C., and ask the question, what does the school health director do to improve the culture of the community so they don't get AIDS, so they don't get pregnancies in the teens, so they understand what they have to do in order to prevent pregnancy, to prevent sexually transmitted disease? That is a public health function which should change some of these parameters. And I think that's the big part of what the Affordable Care Act can deal with. Now, let's ask another question. What do we do in public health in order to achieve, you know, I put up a bunch of wheels here, different wheels, the old wooden ones in the ancients, where you got to go once a year if you needed a little help. The Merchant Consumers Act being the first, Medicare being kind of a hard wooden carriage wheel. We really made a big jump when we added rubber to the tire in 2010. But I would like to see a Michelin banded tire for the future where you get something of real quality. Now, can we get there? What did the Supreme Court do? Here's our friends, right? Now, they actually, if I would have given this a month before June of last year, I would have said, I don't know where we're going. I kind of thought, and I have to say, I did put out to my friends that John Roberts would be the deciding vote, and he would vote for protecting and preserving the Act. And the reason he would do that is because in the Supreme Court, allegedly, all the pictures of the Chief Justices are on the wall, right? One of them is placed 6 inches below all the rest. You know who that is? should be, but no. What's his name? Roger Taney. Roger Taney is the Supreme Court justice who's a little bit below the list. Why? It was the Dred Scott decision. The Dred Scott decision was the cause, or at least one of the causes, or at least was the precipitating event of one of the worst catastrophes that ever hit America. Now, Roberts looks at that every day he comes in, and he says, oh, gee, I know, and the Citizens United was not very well received, and look what he's doing. I'm sure he's got to be aware of what he did with Citizens United. And he looks back and says, you know, they had 5-4 and they got Bush in. That wasn't good either. So he looks at his future and says, where am I going to be in the pantheon of the greats, the Brandeises, the Warrens, and so on, the John Marshalls? If I squash the Affordable Care Act, they're going to dump on me in history like it's going out of style. So I'll find a way to change the game. And so he did find a way to change the game. Okay? These are the bright lights who voted for it. Now, it's interesting that all of these people, the four liberals, and you've got the guy in the middle. It's like, you know, something was shining on us in June of 2012. It's all, and their decision changed the game. It's all about taxes. It's not about the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause is what John Adams used when he signed the Merchant Seamen Bank. Developing a socialized health care system in the United Kingdom, called socialized, a governmentally run system, was good for the economy. It was improving commerce. It enhanced the flow of goods in this country. That's not what he said. He said the mandate to purchase health care is not part of the Commerce Clause. It's a tax. What does that mean? What does that mean? What are about taxes? Congress can now use a tax to achieve an objective. That's what it said. This is a tax to achieve an objective. What's the implication for public health? A tax can be used for public health goals. A tax can influence behavior. A tax can be bigger by a situation. It can invite targeted other targets. It invites targeted taxes. We have used the tax code to achieve major public health objectives in the past. If you look at the taxes, you know, anybody buy cigarettes anymore? If you buy cigarettes, are you still smoking? Huh? Huh? What was that? You can always catch one. What did I do with my? The point is, one of the solutions and one of the technologies to get rid of smoking was to raise the tax on the pack. Young people don't want to pay a lousy pack of cigarettes just so they can get a couple of drags. But I don't think there's many other places we use the tax code. But we have a tax on tanning salons because we know that tanning salons are bad for that, bad for your health, right? Do we have taxes on pollution? We do in a sense, but not really. The Superfund is a big tax on that, but we could expand that. We could say that if your cars do not produce 55 gallons per hour or 55 miles per gallon, you get taxed $1,000 on each car for every mile under that or something like that. So Roberts has given us an opportunity to put a tax on pollution, to tax on alcohol and people. Why not say if you smoke cigarettes, you have to say, you know, check them in your IRS, do you smoke cigarettes? Oh, you do? You say check that off. If you don't, remember, you're going to go to jail because you're lying to the IRS. All right, you can smoke cigarettes and just add another $100 to your tax. Now it's legal. The Supreme Court has said we can do that. How about a body mass tax? I'm sucking myself in. I've been working out for weeks in order to get underneath the 28, man. I don't want to be at the 28 level. I want to make sure that I'm going to be healthy. How about a tax? Well, we should also give a credit. Let's say you say, what's your weight this year? And you put down 315 pounds. Boy, that's bad. And then you come back next year and you're down to 250. Hey, we'll give you $1,000, $2, 200, or whatever it is, $100 for every 100 pounds or whatever. You know, yeah, yeah. you got that right. So you get a tax credit for weight loss. You could get a credit for vaccinating your children. This is a tool which we in public health need to consider. Now, are we going to be able to do it? It can be used for goals, but they can be blocked as well. I mean, look at what they're trying to do here in California. They're trying to get a tax for universal coverage, and they can't get it done. Legislators are not always thinking about public health. So that's one of the problems with this as an objective. And voters don't always understand what they're doing. But the Supreme Court has made this decision, but the Supreme Court's decision isn't going to determine our future. Yeah. Our future is going to be determined in 10 days, 8 days, 9 days. There are four options as I see it. And I think this is one of the scariest things that has come out of this whole situation, because we're sitting on a knife edge. Now, clearly, the Congress could go, option one is Congress stays, or the House stays split the way, or the Republican as it is, the Senate. It looks like the Senate's going to be going at least in the blue, because we're going to get a few senators in some of the good states that they didn't think they were going to get, North Dakota being one. By the way, have you been following the North Dakota thing? North Dakota is going to elect a Democratic senator in what is a red state to replace a Democratic senator. That is one of the great moments in history. I can't tell you how much money I've contributed to Hyden camp, but that's a big thing. We are going to vote for and elect a Democratic senator in Arizona. Who would have thunk it? I mean, this was a giveaway. They haven't had a Democratic senator in Arizona since God created dirt. Or sand. Yeah, I guess it's sand. Or cactuses or whatever. We're going to have a Democrat. There's going to be a Democrat probably in Ohio. There's going to be a Democrat in Missouri. I mean, so we're going to have Democrats where the Republicans thought there would be none. So that's a possibility. The other possibility is that we might lose those Senate seats. I'm assuming that Obama will still be elected president. That's option two. But he may not get elected president. What happened? Yeah, this is bad. I hate this one. This is a nightmare, right? You get that election. That's option three. Huh? No. We go to, oh, wait. Oh, geez. I want to keep your showing. Oh, I had a nice, well, I'll give you the fourth option in a minute. Wait a minute. Oh, yeah, I want to show you the pictures. God, I mean, you know, what good is a PowerPoint if you don't have pictures of your heroes? Anyway, that's, but option four is this. And I think it's important for us to recognize that while this is a low probability, it's not impossible. I think Obama will win. The chances are the Senate will not be that high, maybe, but it will certainly stay in that range. The House, who knows? It could go this way. This is a possibility. How many Democrats are you going to elect in California? You're going to elect a lot. And I hope you're going to elect a few names. Well, some states. They didn't gerrymander. Do you know that Arizona will probably have 9 congressmen, 5 of whom, or maybe 6 of whom, will be Democrats?
Is that gerrymandered the other
way? No, it's not gerrymandered. They actually have a commission that does the right thing. So let's ask ourselves, what the hell would happen under these four options? We don't know what, if the option one takes place, we're back in the same soup bowl that we're in now, and who knows what it is, be gridlock. This is one and two, but option three has a very interesting situation. we will have a Republican Congress and a Republican Senate and a Republican president. The Republicans will probably, they have said, they're going to repeal this law that we've just been talking about. I don't know how they're going to do that. How are you going to tell the 5 million kids that you're now off your mom's and dad's insurance? How are you going to tell all us old creeps that have been getting free preventive services, oh, sorry, guys, you got to go back and pay for it? How are you going to tell the people who were looking forward to not having their, or who were buying insurance because the insurance company couldn't define, say, that your kids had a precondition? Oh, well, sorry, your kid, now you can be cut off from the insurance company. That's going to anger a fair number of people in this country. And then how do you go the next step, which is to tell them that the preconditions that they thought they were going to get, no, get no longer be a problem? So that will be a real issue. And, of course, if they do that, we're going to go back to the Stone Age. I mean, I don't know, that blue one, I guess that one was of John Adams, but it's even before John Adams. So that's what a three probably will lead to. That's not as a reward to say, go to Canada. I've already picked out a piece of land in Vancouver. Right. So we're going to set up a commune in Canada for all of us progressives. I promise you they do that. But if option four takes place, they're going to change the filibuster rules too. And then we're going to be able to get to our Michelin tire, or whatever, belted tire. Actually, they got new tires with no belts in them at all. All they got is and no air in them. Have you seen the new ones with no air? They got things that you ride on nothing. Affordable Care Act will be sold. There is something here that I think we all need to think about, and that is, will the Affordable Care Act help us get to a Medicare for All type of thing, or is it an encumbrance to going that direction? That's a question I can't answer. There's a whole discussion. I don't know how many of you went to the Physicians for National Health Plan program yesterday at the Wyndham, and they're all saying how bad the thing is, and it probably won't go that way or not. But the Affordable Care Act could lead us to a Medicare for All, and we can talk about that if you want to. We might even get rid of Medicaid. Oh, my gosh, how could we get rid of Medicaid? Wouldn't that be terrible? It's a lousy law, guys. As we said earlier, every state is different. What would happen with a Democratic Congress that has a few progressives who would be willing to consider the notion of doing what Senator Anderson, the Tennessee guy, what's his name? Alexander. Senator Alexander, 20 years ago, wrote a letter to the president, and he said, or to the Congress, he said, listen, why, or to the Department of Education and the Department of Health, listen, why don't we make a trade? Why don't we allow all the money that we're putting out in the educational program, through the Department of Education, to go to the states, and then we'll take over the $200 billion that states are paying for Medicaid. So the federal government will pick up the Medicaid program for women and children, for the folks who are in nursing homes, the Medicare, Medicaid folks, and cover that group of people. Now, that, as we saw earlier, those are healthy people, by and large. It's not the people in nursing homes. That's half of them. But most of the people who are covered by Medicaid today are pretty healthy. And put them under a Medicare program. So you would have Medicare from 20 down to zero, including pregnant women and children. So the government pick it up, $300 million. You could probably do it for bargain, because you could save administrative money, because Medicaid costs about 6% and Medicare costs about 2%. So you immediately save 4% of what is about $600 billion. Pocket change. I know, time is going on. Anybody bored? So that's a possibility. That's something that we might even think about arguing for, because then the states would have all of that money to put into public health, to put into other programs that we are interested in, including education and other things. So for public health to prosper, we must achieve option four. We must work with Congress through AMA, APHA, NATO, ASTO, APHA. We must continue, and this is something that we as public health professionals do better than I think anybody else. Maybe not better than anybody else, but we should do it better than anybody else. We should be working from our positions as a public servant to negotiate with, to work with, to leverage the political structure to do the things that they should be doing. We've done that in the past. You know, we've done a lot of good stuff along those lines. We need to do more. And that's a responsibility of them. That's a responsibility of public health people. If Obama loses, we're in trouble. Under any circumstances, whatever we do, improving the ACA at this point, given it to the law, is important. And so regardless of the election, the next 4 years, he's a driver that will achieve success, improve preventive services, improve the primary care and the infrastructure for public health. Look at that chart of the four sections of prevention and work to achieve those objectives. It's not going to be easy. We will survive. And I think if we think about how the Affordable Care Act works, we can make it work for us and achieve the kinds of objectives. So anybody who's got any questions, I'm perfectly willing. Comments? No, we have a commenter. No, let's hear the comment. Yeah, good. I want to hear the response.